I take it you can hear us, Mike, from Japan. Yeah,
I can. Thanks,
Howard. Okay, Mike. You might be a bit quiet, actually. I don't know whether you can switch up your volume.
Really? I'll try. You can't hear me.
It's not too bad, actually. We can. Yeah. Yeah, we can hear you. Yeah. You're such a clear speaker that I'm sure we won't have any trouble. Well, just to thank you for the talk on the recorded talk on Friday, which was I found enormously interesting and informative. It sort of threw up all sorts of questions, which no doubt will arise in the course of this discussion. And it was particularly interesting to hear the sort of take of this Japanese commentator Kazuo Kanishi on sort of things that we're obviously very interested in and close to. Okay, right. Well, should we? Perhaps we can. I notice Mark is already in the queue, so perhaps we can ask Mark to make the first comment or ask the first question, Mark.
Thanks, Howard. Hi, Mike. Great. I listened to you. I wasn't there on Friday, but I listened to your talk this morning. So I've come in sort of hot off the press. And I've got a couple of points, but I think maybe I'll just make one now and then I'll make another one later. And the first thing, because you referred to the whole, Marxist concept of how one mode of production transitions into another, and how, as one mode of production becomes mature and then fails to promote the productive forces, then it gives way to the next one. Or, that's probably a bit of an oversimplification. I thought about, in relation to socialism, I thought about maybe we could also look at it from the point of view, because that's looking at it from the, let's say, from the base element, the economic element. And then there's the whole issue of the people involved and how they experience that transition. And if we were to say, for example, how did feudalism end? Well, it didn't end because feudalism through some impersonal forces ran out of steam. Feudalism ended because it was run by a class of people who gained they gained their wealth through a certain mode, and then another group of people came along who started doing something else, namely the capitalist class, who found that their way of gaining wealth conflicted with the feudal way of gaining wealth, and they came into conflict and they won, because not just because they were cleverer, but because they did represent something that was higher in terms of productivity. And I'm thinking maybe that's part of the answer, looking at how it can be that we can move from capitalism to socialism, not so much to look at some imminent forces developing within the system, but actually to look at the people developing within the system. In other words, the class that is supposed to replace the class, or even, the immense majority whose interests come into conflict with the capitalist class. And finally, that group take power. So looked at from the personal point of view, could we argue that the development of the socialist, as it were, mode of production, or however we would want to call it, is actually the development of the consciousness of the identity of the class, sort of bringing those two things together straight away.
Right. Should I talk now? Thank you. Yeah, you raised so many good points there that it's actually trying to gather my thoughts. But that's how I thought of it myself, actually. I don't think of it as like feudalism would have just automatically collapsed or capitalism is going to automatically collapse. I think Adam mentioned that an era of social revolution implies a sort of long period of time. So when I'm thinking about maybe comparing a socialist revolution to the case of a bourgeois revolution, it does seem like it was it's both, really, isn't it? I mean, it's both the objective situation where feudalism was becoming a fetter, where in many respects it was limiting the development of productive power, I guess you could say. But I mean, at the same time, none of the people that were leading the revolution against it were necessarily experts on feudalism and were analyzing that mode of production. I mean, all sort of the revolution itself all took place on the level of human consciousness. So I would totally agree with that. So in a way, I think Patty mentioned that a lot of this is sort of like reading tea leaves when you're trying to predict what's going to happen with capitalism. And I would agree with that too, because ultimately it's not really going to play out on the level of Marxist theoreticians' playbook necessarily. But I do think it's, I guess what really interests me is just the combination, the relation between the two, a system that is becoming less and less able to, I guess you would say it's losing its dynamism, and at the same time, people are becoming more aware of that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned, actually, from the feudal, the bourgeois revolution that swept aside feudalism in kind of grasping that relation between the objective and the subjective side of things. Of course, in that case, there was actually, you know, capitalist relations of production were already in existence. So it's a little bit different, but I think maybe in the case of a socialist revolution, like you said, we have to look more at people's way of thinking. We don't have necessarily socialistic relations that are going to develop within capitalism, some like reformists might think, but obviously there has to be some major shift in the way that people are thinking, and I guess that would be come tangible in some way. But I don't know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that relation between the objective and the subjective is what interests me, because I think in my talk I maybe gave people the impression that Konishi was saying that capitalism is going to collapse, or we can just sit back and, you know, its days are numbered. I don't think he was really saying that. I probably gave that impression a little bit, but I think he's just, I mean, it's going to continue until people put an end to it, basically. But the fact that it is in that sort of state of stagnation or whatever you want to call it does mean that people are more likely to become opposed to it. So, yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that relation between the two things is what fascinates me most, but it's a bit hard to sort of put your finger on it exactly.
Thanks for that, Mike. Mark, do you want to come back on that?
I would. I agree exactly what Michael said. I agree entirely. I mean, I guess I have two questions related to that. I mean, I think the feudal system, I mean, in principle, feudalism, I presume, just like every other system, could have continued. I mean, we don't know, of course, we're looking back in time, and we can often have like a teleological view of things, that we think everything has got to go up to today. But in theory, it could have continued. It would have been a stagnating, just like it probably has done in some parts of the world. It would just stagnate for a very long period of time, and who knows, might have stagnated until the end of the world. So in other words, the first element is feudalism could have continued, couldn't it? And then the second question is, wouldn't a war be an awfully good way of resetting the clock on some of the processes you've been talking about? And in fact, isn't that what we see? I mean, I think a good war would certainly solve a lot of capitalism's problems.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have that fear too, actually. Yeah. The second point about the war, that actually does sort of, especially with the way things are moving recently, not to become like, you know, fear-mongering about it, but it does seem like, yeah, that would be one way. But I mean, of course, that comes at great risk to the capitalists themselves in the age of nuclear war. So maybe even they would hesitate a bit. But that would be one way to reset things, although it might reset them a little bit too far back than they might have wanted to reset them. Also mentioned, yeah, I guess, any society, I suppose there are many examples of societies that just stagnated and then withered away or were taken over or conquered. by some other more maybe advanced mode of production. I suppose that's always possible. I mean, I don't know what Marx's answer to that would be, actually. Maybe someone else knows.
Thanks, Mike. Paddy, over to you.
I just want to develop the point that you made us a minute ago, Mike, that when you said, you know, what happened in the change to capitalism was that capitalist processes or forces were already in existence within feudalism, and you know, the force of these processes pushed feudal restrictions aside. I think, I mean, you know, say guilds, for example. So those processes were already in existence within feudalism. The thing I wonder, though, is that I mean, this was a major change, obviously, but it was a change within property society, within the overall paradigm of property society. But what we're proposing is a complete change of paradigm, so from property to, you know, common property. That's not the same thing at all as the process, as the change from feudalism to capitalism. So how does our theory stack up in that situation? We've either got to say, well, we can't learn anything from the change from feudalism to capitalism because that wasn't a paradigm change, but socialism is a paradigm change. Or we can learn something from the feudal capitalism process. And therefore, that implies that socialist forces need, therefore, to be already in existence within capitalism. Now, if that's what we're arguing, well, what are these socialist forces that already exist? Where are they? I can't see that you can have it both ways. You know, either we're going to follow the sort of feudal to capitalism playbook, or we have to say, well, no, that doesn't really apply, and so the rules are completely different. I wonder what you think about that, Mike.
Well, there is the working class, I suppose. I mean, they're running everything already. So maybe in the case of, you know, feudalism, capitalism kind of emerged, I mean, within it in a sense, but also kind of next to it and more than sort of within it. Whereas capitalism, I mean, we're right in it, in the middle of it, I suppose. We're running it, so... I mean, I guess it's hard to make a direct comparison. I don't know if that means that you can't draw lessons from that former revolution, but as far as the conditions existing, I mean, there aren't like little islands of socialism existing, of course, even though I guess some people want to try that. But I guess just, I don't know, I would just say the working class and the fact that, I mean, if you just look at the past 100 years, the degree to which, like, the notion of equality, at least in many countries, here in Japan, I mean, I go to the convenience store, there's not, like, you don't have to bow down to me as the customer or something. I mean, it's, maybe some of them do, but, I mean, there's this just notion of equality that didn't exist before. So I suppose it gets back to that notion that, yeah, the consciousness itself is sort of the condition, I guess I'd say. Sorry, it's not a very good answer.
Thanks, Mike. Jordan, can you mute yourself? You're probably not aware that you're not muted.
Oh, yeah, my bad.
There we go. Sorry about that. My bad, yeah. Right, Adam, it's you next.
No, I think the material basis for socialism has evolved under capitalism, just as the material basis for capitalism evolved under feudalism. And the material basis for socialism is socialized production. The fact that everything is interconnected, even on a world scale. So what we've got already, socialized production, what we haven't got is social ownership of what's produced. So I don't see that Paddy's dilemma arises. I also don't agree that feudalism could have continued forever, because I mean, human beings are always looking for more effective ways to produce things to, you know, to satisfy their needs, and that went on under feudalism and would have continued. At some point, people would have invented more you know, different methods of production, and there would have been a class of people who would have championed these new methods of production, and capitalism would have evolved. I mean, I think that well, I don't agree that feudalism could have continued forever. I've got some points to make on Kanishi's thing, but I'll wait till the discussion reaches that point.
Mike, do you want to come back on that, or you don't have to?
Oh no, you just said it much better than I could have said it. But yeah, I would agree with the bit about socialization of labor. Certainly, yeah.
Okay, Adam. Thanks for your clarity of mind, Adam. Okay, Paul, next.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Conrad. Yeah, lovely to be here and be part of this. Thank you, Mike. It was a beautifully presented talk and such a lovely mellow American accent you have. I could have listened to it all day long. I see, if I can maybe even use something like the jigsaw analogy, if you think of as in the process of making a 1,000-piece jigsaw, and we've maybe got about 500 pieces there, and we've got about another 500 to go. And you can potentially even translate that to the last 1,000 years, for example, and how things are changing, how we're moving along, and how we're evolving in one thing or another. By default, as much as anything, I think, and you consider even, for example, going all the way back to the start of, you know, the whole Big Bang theory, you know, and it took this sort of unique set of circumstances for the Earth to come into creation, or for the Earth to materialise in the way that it does, and all these kind of microorganisms starting to sort of leave the sea and eventually become species, and the whole theory of evolution and stuff. Well, I think if you think of that as the social situation we find ourselves in, past, present, and what the future may hold for us. I mean, Adam makes some terrific points. He always does. Everyone does. I particularly like Janet Carter's contribution on Friday when she's talking about the whole sort of idea of having a mindset revolution. I've no doubt that the circumstances are there. We could quite easily, if we had the will to do it, the knowledge and experience to do it, switch, and we could quite easily have socialism tomorrow if only there was the will to do it. The circumstances, the productive capacity, everything's already sitting there waiting just to happen. And the majority of us want it to happen, and the majority of us have got the knowledge to make it happen. It's just a case of it all falling into place, so to speak. I think, you know, we're well on the way there. We've still got a wee bit to go. We're just waiting for that little sort of switch to be thrown in people's minds and people's knowledge. I mean, the capacity's there. You were using the example of how, you know, in Japan, there's all these, and as there is in many parts of the world, all these cars sitting in car lots or you know, just sitting there doing nothing. It's another example of wastefulness, how, you know, people have speculated, capitalists have speculated for the production of cars. And they're sitting there doing nothing because people already have, those who can afford it, already have enough cars. In other words, their needs have not already been met. They're exceeded. And in other words, nobody's going to spend money on stuff that they don't already need. But commodities, consumer goods, call it what you want, are sitting there doing nothing because of lack of affordability. So there is, of course, so much waste within the world as it stands. And I suspect that over time, with the communication tools that we've got, eventually people will get switched on. And we can do our bit along the way, but eventually there'll come a time where there has to be this consciousness, this recognition. So whether or not we're halfway through the jigsaw or two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the jigsaw, eventually that last piece will fall into place by either a sort of common denominator or by some other means. But get there we will, comrades, and I think that's the important thing to hold on there. Do our bit as best we can, and hopefully more and more people across the world will come to recognise what a wasteful world we live in. I'll just round off by comparing. I've used this example before. Many of us will know here about our good Glasgow comrades such as Dick Donnelly and Vic Vanney. Vic Vanney and I used to sit and mull this over many a time, you know, how and well, you know, over a beer or even just a coffee and stuff like that. And we'd end up tying ourselves in knots sometimes because there is no easy answers. Of course there isn't. We can theorise and we can speculate as much as we can, but it'll happen when the time is right. I worry, again, you know, as rightly been pointed out by others, of the fear of this of massive onslaught where everyone ends up bloody killing themselves in an act of desperation. But I think what is quite as much as likely is for it to happen naturally. I can see this, again, going back to the whole big bag thing, about some sort of destructive force, a bit like what wiped out the dinosaurs, you know, whatever that may be, probably a collision or something. And then from that, you know, a bit like, it's a bit corny, a bit cheesy, but like, almost like a phoenix rising out of the fire, socialism will then come to being when people will realise the importance of meeting each other's needs rather than seeking or being driven by the motivation of profit, you know. But, I mean, that's just my kind of idea. Of course, there are many, many more out there, some much, much better than that which I've described, but that's how I see it playing out. And that's probably enough for me for now. So thanks for that, Mike. Thanks again. I'll stop waffling on. Cheers, comrades. Cheers.
It's great to hear you, Paul. And I'm glad you don't mind my Midwestern monotone so much. That's nice to hear.
Not monotone. You know, I was fearful about using that. Not monotone. What was it I said? Not monotone. What was the word I used?
That's how it seems.
Mellow. Melotone. Oh, God. Are you insulting with that?
No. Lovely. That's my, yeah, no. Lovely. I know you didn't say it, but that's what I think.
All right. Okay. No. Hey, it's even better than some of the professional audio books that I listen to, comrade. But yeah, thanks for that. Cheers. Good man.
Yes, Paul. Yeah, I mean, I like your optimistic take on that. And I mean, yeah, I guess like other people said, it's all kind of speculation. So in a way, at the end of the day, it doesn't really change. I mean, what you would do as a socialist every day, you just keep plugging away, right? So, but yeah, in that sense, I'm not sure how much it's worth pondering this sort of thing, but I guess every sort of, you know, various groups have their own sort of notion, and a lot of them have a sort of cataclysmic idea. You know, there's going to be this great crisis, like a depression, like the 1930s, and then it's going to radicalize the workers. And I mean, I think most of the vanguardist parties have that idea. And then once the workers are in sort of a panic or whatever, and then you can just sort of, they're going to follow you or you can push them or whatever. So I mean, that's not my view, but at the same time, I do think objective situation, again, going back to the bourgeois revolution, but I mean, certainly the fact that, you know, it occurred in 18th century France, in the case of France, is like, it's not a complete accident. I mean, I guess it could have happened a century before, but certainly things had reached a sort of head, and I'm certainly for decades, probably people experienced a sort of a, not a crisis in a sort of cataclysmic crisis, but just sort of a certain malaise or whatever you want to call it. And certainly I feel that here in Japan. I came here in 1995, so right after the bubble. The good thing is that kind of, all the riffraff that had come here maybe to make money had already left by that time, so no one was coming here to make money anymore. But people were very apolitical and like jaded, and I think maybe because their parents were all communist supporters or Marxists, like the young people didn't want anything to do with socialism, Marx, none of that. And it's gone on for like 30 years, but I've noticed in the past 5 years, there has been a change. And actually, a book by a Marxist, I think Adam met him in London, Saito, his book has sold 350,000 copies since last October. It's a best-selling book. I've seen this guy, I see him everywhere. I can't really avoid him these days. I just saw him on the news the other night. And he's basically saying capitalism day is done. But I think he has a similar sort of reformism, now I can't even remember the name of the person of Konishi. So there's that. But at the same time, that's a big change here in Japan. So, I mean, I know people have seen things come and go. We've seen radical waves come and go, and I'm old enough to have seen a few myself. I do think there's something slightly different now. I don't know if this is the era of social revolution or whatever, but certainly something's a bit different. And same in the States with the Trump phenomenon, and then there's Brexit. There's lots of things going on now. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, overexcited about it. It's easy to get disappointed later. But I would say, yeah, just I guess what I'm trying to, in response to what Paul was saying, I mean, it is hard to predict, and I obviously I have no clue either, but I do think the so-called objective situation, the objective situation, which is made up of subjective actions at the same time, but it does play a huge role. So, yeah, I guess it doesn't really affect what we do as socialists, but I guess in the back of my mind, you kind of keep an eye on it just to see which way the wind's blowing, I suppose you could say.
Thanks, Mike. Steve now.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I wanted to raise a question that came up in the Friday meeting. I think it was Howard that asked it, which is, could you give us some sort of idea about what Kanishi and this Saito that you just mentioned are talking about? But before you tell us about that, Mike, this idea of that is fairly prevalent amongst the left, that once capitalism goes into a depression, then we enter a revolutionary situation. This is the most trite nonsense I've ever come across, because at that stage, all that you can possibly think about, if you're a member of the working class, is how do I feed my kids? How do I pay my rent? And the idea that it's propitious for a socialist revolution is, and I don't know. I don't think it's got any basis in reality at all. We are more likely to have the spread of socialist ideas when workers are actually better off, when workers have got they've got the time to think about alternatives. Yeah, okay. I'll leave it at that. So, if you could give us an idea about the general political ideas of Kanishi, etc. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Kanishi, I met him a couple times. I think he's must be in his early 70s. And it's kind of interesting. Like, he and this other guy Otani, who he was a bit older, and that generation were all, I guess you'd call them fellow travelers of the Communist Party. I don't really, they're not political activists, but could figure out from talking to them, I mean, that's was their basic outlook. But you know, with the fall, the collapse of the Soviet Union, one thing that did change that's a positive change is that the notion of socialism changed quite a bit. So, actually, their idea of socialism is not much different than ours now. I mean, they call it association, but it's a world without money, without wage labor. So that's a kind of an extraordinary change, because one thing about Japan, and I think maybe John Crump noted that, he probably noted this in because he lived here and he was kind of looking for libertarian socialist tendencies here in Japan, and he didn't find anything. That's true. There was an anarchist tradition back in the 20s, but pretty much all of them went over to the Bolshevik side. And then there was, you know, after the war, there was a sort of Trotskyist movement without Trotsky, the new left here. So they were basically all Leninists and all firm believers that the Soviet Union was some sort of worker state or something. But, you know, now people like Konishi, this Otani person from that older generation, their notion of socialism, yeah, completely changed. So I feel like this is a huge positive thing. I noticed it in many academic books. There are a lot of Marxist economists here, by the way. It's like you wouldn't believe how many there are. They're ensconced in the university, so it's very different than the United States. But whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. But anyway, a lot of people are writing about association, you know, this concept, but I think where they hang on to their old Stalinism or reformism is that how you get there. I mean, they tend to have a sort of two-stage or a gradual sort of transitional idea. So, I mean, the positive side is that their notion of socialism is not what it used to be. It's not state capitalism. It's completely different. So that's a step forward, I for sure, I think. Although it's a bit insidious how they kind of combine that with their reformism. And I think Saito is much younger. He's in his 30s. I translated a book by a guy named Sasaki, and he's Saito's sort of slightly older colleague. And he also has the same kind of view. He's a little bit less reformist, as far as I can tell, but still has this notion that unless we build up a sort of power to resist capital within capitalism, there's no way we're going to be able to make a socialist revolution. But on the plus side, again, is that their notion of socialism has actually come over very close to what our concept is. So I view that as like a pretty huge change, actually. But yeah, they've kind of, unfortunately, they've hung on to the reformist bit. And again, there's nothing, there's no sort of organization, you know, of libertarian socialism over here, unfortunately.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for that, Mike. Thanks very much indeed. Can I just say, it's Pat next, but before I ask Pat to speak, can I just say myself that I think you're absolutely right. There's, in recent times, there's been a whole slew of books by writers, mostly academics, calling themselves Marxists, who are roundly condemning capitalism. Some of them coming up with the kind of thing that we're looking for, well, without money or wage labor. Not that many, actually. Most of them don't go that far. They condemn capitalism, but haven't really sort of, you know, got a reasonable alternative. But at the same time, they sort of seem to think you can get these sort of small changes within capitalism, which will, you know, which will sort of make things a bit better. At the same time, they manage to sort of see things as incremental. And I got the impression from listening to your talk on Konishi on Friday that's very much what he's like. And you've sort of confirmed that. Okay. Can we pass over to Pat now? Thanks.
Thank you. Hello. I'm very pleased to be present at this meeting. I'd start with commenting on what Comrade Finch said about possibly workers needing time to think as being a better position to be in for the growth of understanding of their position. But what seems to have happened with workers, some workers being better off and having more money to spend, there's been an increase in the sale of leisure activities. So that, in fact, the time that they might have for thinking is spent on keeping fit and other kinds of activities. One of the things that seems to really get in the way of workers looking at their common identity, common problems, is this the success of divide and rule. And I don't know if anyone, you know, capitalists sit around and decide that this is what they're going to promote, but it's certainly successful with workers with the power of nationalism and patriotism that I regard as twin evils. But that seems to be such a powerful force, and workers with problems blaming other workers, workers from a different, if I can put it like that, tribe, meaning that in a more general way, but blaming other workers and all sorts, and that seems to be promoted by government when they set workers who don't have jobs as though it's their own fault. It's as though, and as a government minister said a couple of days ago, that people on government schemes don't want to go back to work at you know, just to stir up the feelings against them. But on the point about there some crisis or other, well, what the virus seems to have done is put really spotlight on money, and both on the one hand on money and on the other on community and people volunteering to do work and getting pleasure out of their voluntary work and their closer community. So that's a positive factor. But the money thing really sort of shows what a, almost from our point of view, what a nonsense it is that that people can't get their everyday needs without access to money and the supply of jobs and jobs to make things to compete with other as capitalism is with other producers and sellers, so that. Try to be optimistic, because if we can't be optimistic, that's not very good. At the time scale, who knows? But there are these different sort of strands that go on. But what really is the basic thing is the understanding of the system, understanding capitalism and how it works, and that to me is the most sort of vital thing. And well, thank you very much to Mark for this this talk and so on. Thank you.
My brother's name is Mark, so you sound like my mom, and often got those mixed up. Yeah.
Thank you.
Just but I mean, I think people looking for something automatic to change capitalism, like maybe even this, you know, crisis, it does change people's ideas about some things, but yeah, it's not going to sort of just do everything for us, unfortunately, but yeah.
Thanks, Pat. Mike, Adam, over to you now.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to Konishi. It doesn't surprise me that he did have a background in the Communist Party, because I think he's still thinking in terms of capitalism and perhaps socialism in one country, because in the summary of his book that you sent, he says the historical mission of capitalism, of development of production capacity, is coming to an end in developed countries. He's just saying it's coming to an end in one country, perhaps in his case Japan, and maybe America. But of course capitalism is a world system, it's an international system. And I don't think that you could make out a case that capitalism has come to an end, or is coming to an end in the whole of the world. I mean, capitalism is still developing in places like China, India, South America, Indonesia, and parts of the world like that. So, I mean, it is, in fact, am I right in thinking that his analysis is just based on the idea that capitalism exists as a separate system in different countries, so that one capitalist, one part of capitalism can come, reach stagnation, while the rest of capitalism continues. What's my question about the man himself?
I don't think he would take it that far. I think, but it's true. I think he does have that. I probably connected to his reformism, that he has this notion that probably Japan could implement some sort of transitional policies or something or other that might lead to socialism. But I would say that, though, I think I listened to the comments on Friday, and I think you mentioned that capitalism already reached its sell-by date, maybe even 100 years ago in the case of England. But there was, of course, a global capitalism. But at the same time, I think global capitalism is sort of an abstraction, because it's made up of all these other, these capitalist nations. So I don't think he's necessarily wrong to analyze, Japan or the United States to look at the situation, because as I sort of mentioned as well, China is in this state of high growth now. So everyone seems to think that they've got something, I don't know, that they've sort of figured out something that we haven't figured out. But I mean, it's kind of like Marx said in that preface to Capital about how more developed country just shows the less developed country what its future is going to be like, an image of its own future or something like that. So one thing I would say that's different is, I mean, capitalism today, but compared to 100 years ago, I think there are countries like Japan that have pretty much developed product power, you know, pretty much as far as it can go under capitalism. With, I mean, they've benefited from the global market, of course, and from China's growth. But I mean, even that is becoming, they become, of course, at some stage, not just a source of resources and cheap labor, but they become a competitor. So, I mean, I guess, I don't know if I'm defending Konishi here, but I guess from my perspective, I mean, things are quite different today in the sense that these countries that, like China, that are developing are going to probably reach the same sort of saturation of their domestic markets at some point too. So, of course, there's probably still room for capitalism to grow, but it does seem like in the so-called developed countries, they have reached a sort of plateau in a sense. So, I mean, global capitalism is kind of an abstraction. You just say because it's global, there'll always be room for growth. I guess at the current stage, yes, there's India, there's China, but even they, I mean, if you look at Japan's post-war growth, it was like the basic growth was from 19, you know, early 60s to, it was a relatively short period of time. So, I mean, China is growing now, but yeah, how long is that going to last? I don't know. But but I don't think his argument is necessarily that Japan could achieve socialism in one country or something like that. But his book is looking at Japan and the United States. So, but I think you can't really, I don't think you can really start an analysis of capitalism by just starting from global capitalism. I think you always have to actually analyze a particular country, just like Marx, when he wrote Capital, he analyzed, you know, English capitalism, and from that he drew a lot of conclusions. But I don't think you can really even analyze global capitalism. It's sort of an abstraction in a sense.
Do you want to come back at all on that, Adam?
Well, he is drawing conclusions from the situation in Japan for the whole world. I mean, if he's saying that, you know, we're entering an era of social revolution, or an era of social and political revolution, but based on what's happening in Japan, so he is sort of you know, transferring what's happening there as if it's happening to capitalism world scale.
Yeah, I guess he would say that this same thing is going to play out in other countries as well. And it's already playing out in Western Europe, the United States, and Japan, and then probably a matter of time before in China as well. What else was I going to say? I forgot what I was going to say. Anyway.
Thanks, Mike. Right, the names on the speaking queue seem to have disappeared. I noticed before they did that Mark had something more to say, but before he does, can I just mention something that Steve's asked me to mention, and that is that the article by Konishi, which Mike has referred to, is on the speaking queue. It's just above the names, which have actually disappeared now. But anyway, if you're on the speaking queue, you'll see that. Okay, so I think it's Mark next.
Yeah, just to add something to what some people were saying about the fact that capitalism as a system is sort of coming under discussion, as being brought up, even if the authors are not going, let's say, all the way to socialism. From a Polish perspective, I've been here since 2000, January 2000, actually. Have returned a few times to the UK, but basically moved out here in January 2000. And at that time, so that was only 10 years, that would have been 10 years after what in Poland is called the transformation of 1989-90. It was very rare for people to conceive of capitalism as a system. The system was always socialism, what they called socialism or communism. And if they called this, what we live in now, anything, it would just be called democracy. And I remember very often when I would try to introduce into any conversation the name capitalism, it was jarring, because this isn't this isn't a system. This is just what people do. You know, you buy and sell, you work for, you know, it's nature. And so I regard it as really a very important step that actually, including here in Poland, capitalism as a system is being discussed. An author we don't comment on very much, I haven't heard us comment very much on anyway, is Yuval Noah Harari. He's an interesting character, and no doubt we have our views on him, but he's kind of introduced some form of a historical materialism, for example, in his book, Sapiens. And it's amazing that in a country like Poland, where we hardly have even anyone who calls himself left in parliament, I mean, left wing in parliament, there's a handful, but nevertheless, you know, Harari's book has been a bestseller in Poland. I mean, it's rare to find an educated person who hasn't actually sort of read Harari or know of Harari. So I think there is a great it's greatly positive that people are starting to talk about capitalism not as a force of nature but as a system. It's an abstraction, as Michael says, but almost every label we use is an abstraction. So I'm not sure how valid that kind of criticism is. That's just what I want. That's just a general observation.
Thanks, Mark. Harari, far from being a socialist, of course. Very interesting book, though, I agree. We don't have anybody else in the speaking queue at the moment. Perhaps I can, given that, I can bring up a question that's sort of been floating around the last half hour or so. And that's the question which I think you sort of broached, Mike, early on, as to whether capitalism is actually stagnating on a world scale. This is the sort of, you know, big new thing, isn't it? All these writers who are writing about these Marxist academics writing about capitalism, saying that, you know, it's coming to an end, it can't go on, things are getting worse, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm always reserving my judgment on that kind of thing, because we know from experience that capitalism is constantly going through sort of, as it were, good times and bad times. And simply because at the moment, even maybe the last 30 years, the times have been relatively bad in certain ways. You know, who knows whether capitalism will find the resilience, and it is a resilient system, to break out of that and sort of, you know, move forward in a way that, well, may or may not sort of be of advantage to the development of socialist ideas. Don't know if you have anything further to say on that issue about, you know, possible stagnation of the system on a world scale, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I can only really speak to where I live, but I mean, I would be like you, hesitant to say. I mean, I guess, yeah, this Konishi book just sort of, for me, it was just interesting to kind of consider this issue, because Marx does talk a lot about, you know, capitalism, it's born, you know, it's going to live and it's going to die at some point. And but I don't know, it doesn't seem like we necessarily think about it that much, probably rightly so, because a lot of these academics maybe because they are academics, they prefer this image of capitalism sort of stagnating and then just withering away or something like that. But, and I mean, it is really hard to say, because there's, I mean, these whole vast parts of the globe, I guess, like Adam was saying, so maybe I just go against what I said earlier, but I mean, there is South America, there's India, there's, I mean, vast parts of the globe that do have certainly room for development, I guess, if you want to use that word. But so it's really hard to say. Certainly Japan has been stagnant for 30 years, and no signs of any getting out of that situation anytime soon.
Thanks, Mike. Dan has been forcibly muted all along, but he wants to speak now. And Steve, you've unmuted him now. Thanks very much. Okay, over to you, Danny.
Good morning, comrades. This is, might sound a bit garbled, because I wasn't expecting to be doing this on a Sunday morning. But I joined the Socialist Party. One of the things that attracted me to the Socialist Party was it was radical. It went to the root of the problem. And if I may indulge in a bit of sloganeering, all societies are social relationships. And the more we know about what we're relating with and who we're relating to, the more functional that relationship will be. Well, with that in mind, I have a look at the way the world's running with capitalism. It runs on mistaken identity, nationalism, racism, all that kind of thing. And so another slogan, the more we know, the more we can do, the better we know, the better we can do. So I think if we live in a social relationship, the more we know about what we're relating with and who we're relating to, the more functional that relationship will be. So I had a look a couple of months back, which set this whole thing in motion, a page in Wikipedia on genetics. It turned out that humans, all of us, are no more distantly related than 16th cousin, and that we all share the greatest of all great-grandparents. So that's the basis, the root of our relationship. So in fact, we're members of the same family, all of us. And as I might have said before, as I say, capitalism runs in denial of this, because we cannot exploit or oppress or abuse in any way the people that we identify with. So I figure it wouldn't be a bad idea to promote the idea that we're all members of the same family, because in a functional family, we bring according to ability and we take according to need. So that's my basic idea, roughly put and very briefly put. So it's over to you. And by the way, I didn't hear Mike's talk this morning. I came on this talk this morning, just after 11. So I'm sure it's really good. So over to you, comrades, with that one.
Thanks. I was just going to say, I hope that view can take root more over here in Japan, because there is sometimes people seem to forget that we're all part of the human race occasionally over here.
Paddy, you now.
I just want to kind of develop that point, actually, that Danny made about the, you know, the human race is one functional family. I don't think we disagreed, would we, that the global working class is a highly dysfunctional family at the moment. So I just want to kind of talk about what Pat mentioned earlier on. She sort of alluded to, you know, workers, you know, not focusing on class consciousness, but kind of getting carried, you know, getting diverted by identity politics. And I want to talk about this in relation to something that Janet said on Friday, which has already been referred to, when she talked about the mindset revolution. What I want to ask is, what if there is a mindset revolution going on at the moment and we just don't recognise it for what it is? We actually think it's something else. Now, what I'm going to argue is that identity politics, which is the great sort of, you know, the thing that we all oppose because it's supposedly dividing workers and it distracts people from class consciousness. If you take a broader view of this, a sort of overview, a historical view of this, actually, I think you'd probably agree that any progression towards a genuine global class consciousness has got to involve workers learning about each other and learning to respect each other, including understanding and respecting their differences and the diversity between them and among them. And and also, this process of greater class consciousness has got to include an awareness of the discriminations which workers perpetrate on each other based on these differences and this diversity. Now, we can't be united as a global working class until we understand the ways that we ourselves undermine that unity. Now, if you think about when the SPGB was formed back in the early 1900s, there was almost no discussion about these differences, about this diversity. It certainly existed, but there was no discussion about it. There was no discussion, very little discussion about racism, about sexism, homophobia. These other differences, they remained latent divisions within the working class. And in the drive to develop, you know, sort of Marxist class consciousness, I think there's a case to be made that these things were just swept under the carpet. So if I'm right, then real class unity at that time was largely illusory. Now, what's happening now is that these divisions, this diversity is being brought out in the open. It's being examined. It's being scrutinized. Workers are being challenged to understand and respect things that previously they ignored or marginalized or, in fact, abused. Now, this process is quite painful at the moment. The whole process of identity politics is mired in disputes and rows and mutual hostility. It is a painful process, but what I want to argue is that it's arguably an important and necessary stepping stone to a real and genuine class consciousness. And we cannot sidestep this process. What we need to do is embrace it and say, underneath all of these differences, underneath all this diversity, which we do recognise and we do respect and we do oppose all the discriminations, underneath all of that, there is this genuine class consciousness, this functional family that Danny's talking about. That's what I want to propose, is the mindset revolution that's going on at the moment. And yet we seem to insist on seeing it as a bad thing. Arguably, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing and a necessary thing.
Thanks, Paddy. Very interesting, definitely. Anybody want to comment on that or on anything else? I noticed, by the way, that we have people in this meeting. We have comrades not just from the UK and Japan, but from New Zealand, from Poland, from the US. Maybe, hopefully, prefiguring world socialism. Yeah, people from all over the world, basically, which is obviously very, very good indeed from our point of view. Dougie, we've got you next.
I was interested in what Mark said or whatever about Noah Harari. I read his recent book, really. Yeah, he's very good at describing capitalism and how societies have developed, although he kind of called Russia communist or whatever. But, I mean, he has no solutions in the end. His most recent book, he finishes by saying meditation's the answer, right? Yeah, because you can't do anything about a lot of these things, right? Yeah. But he is an interesting author, and some of the facts that he comes up with are very fascinating, right? You know? Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. And I agree with Paddy about identity politics and stuff like that, right? Okay.
Can I just say that Harari claims more recently to have been, and that since the last book you're talking about, Dougie, can't think of the name of it. It's not Sapiens was the one before. But anyway, he claims to have been profoundly influenced by Rutger Bregman, who has written this book called Humankind, which was recently reviewed in The Standard. And Bregman is actually, certainly in terms of his view of human nature and the capacity of humans to cooperate and empathise and so on, very, very close indeed to our position. So maybe the next book that Harari writes will be sort of, you know, closer to our position, as it were, than the ones he's written so far in terms of, you know, solutions, etc. Mark, you now.
Yeah, I just want to come back on that. I mean, I read recently, I was reading another book where the author made a distinction between, you know, a descriptive assessment of the situation and prescriptive, meaning giving the solutions and the way forward. And it may be maybe along the lines of Marx is saying, you know, philosophers have tried to understand the world. The point is to change it. But of course, changing the world depends on understanding the world. And, you know, we're all the time, everything we talk about is somehow related to the question of consciousness. And we're looking to see, are there any clouds on the horizon as big as a man's hand that could become, you know, a torrent? I was simply observing that, you know, the popularity of Harari, although I absolutely thoroughly 100% agree that so far prescriptively, he's very disappointing. especially when you get excited about the descriptive element. But if people begin to embrace some of the descriptive elements and the question of the existence of a system called capitalism, and a system can be changed or a system can be become outmoded, etc. It's not nature. Whenever people are describing reality correctly, that's one step towards actually the prescription. Very often people don't go that far. And I think, one of our ambitions should be to take the accurate descriptions that people make and then say, okay, so what do you prescribe? And when the prescription is capitalism or a reformed version of capitalism, we can point that out and say, no, you said capitalism is shit. So, and what you're proposing is more capitalism. I mean, it gives us a leg to start. It gives us a platform to stand on. So I think it's quite interesting to apply this descriptive and prescriptive issue that you might say this economist describes the phenomenon really well. He just fails or she fails at the point of prescription, meaning what should be done. And I think that's one of the things that we have that we can bring. But there's a mass of good description going on right now, which is only to be welcomed.
Thanks, Mark. I certainly like that. You're criticizing capitalism, but what you're proposing is more capitalism. That's exactly what a lot of these people are doing. Yeah. Adam, you now.
I don't want to divert the discussion, but just to place on record that there are party members who fundamentally disagree with what Paddy says. Identity politics is a lot of shit, and it just divides the working class, and we shouldn't have anything to do with it. Just placing that on record. I don't want to discuss it any further.
Okay, Adam. Paddy and you can have the argument together, maybe. Richard. Can you unmute Richard?
Hello, comrades. Good morning. I don't want to drift off and get into a big debate about identity politics, but I think the interesting point to note is how capitalism is so adaptable. There's a realization within the capitalist class that there's more profit to be made by getting all workers as productive as possible. So people who are marginalized for whatever reason, their race, their sex, sexual orientation, disability, we need to screw them all equally. I mean, that's one angle of identity politics that, you know, it's an equal oppression of the working class. And that's, I think that's a fundamental point as socialists we should make, that this apparent social advance, you know, oh yes, it's a great thing that we're getting rid of discrimination, prejudice, whatever. But it's good that it's happened, but it's only happened now because at this stage of capitalism, they can, how bosses can see the advantage. That's all.
Thanks, Richard. Should we go to Leon?
Hello, comrades. Can you hear me?
Yeah, fine.
Great. So, first of all, thanks, Mike. Greetings from a fellow person who has lived in Japan for several years. So, yoroshiku onegai shimasu. But I wanted to of things regarding capitalism as described from the point of view of one country versus global capitalism. Is just having lived in Japan, I think specifically for people in Japan, they kind of tend to see everyone, the whole world, basically being a continuation of Japan, or they cannot imagine the way of life that is radically different from Japanese. That's something I've noticed talking to people. Maybe, I don't know if or whether it's true or not, maybe that's effective description of sort of Japanese capitalism, you know, put as an example for the whole world. But something I think that's very important to note is that since at least 2000, it's impossible to talk about capitalism in just one country. It's globalization. It's global networks of transportation and resources, mines, and so forth. So if you think about capitalism as a system that depends on quite large working class supporting a much, much smaller part of the society that holds the, the finance, the means of production, then as capitalism grows more and more, then proportionally that working class also has to grow. And so inevitably, it goes all over the world. And at some point, the limits will hit in. And at this point, I think the main limit that we are starting to see now is materials. So raw resources, destruction of the environment, and so forth. And I think this is the biggest contradiction that's coming and that could help more people realize the capitalism as actually a system rather than, as Mark noted, something natural, as they see also in Poland. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Leon. I don't know whether you want to come back on that at all, Mike. You're unmuted, but we can't hear you at the moment, Mike. I think something's happened to your connection. Whether you want to go out and come in again, I don't know. Right, we seem to have lost Mike for the moment, but should we...
Howard, excuse me, technically, we can tell that Mike is trying to speak if his name lights up, mine's doing now. I don't know whether you're aware of that.
Yeah, I was, and it wasn't lighting up, that's right, yeah. Okay. Are you there now, Mike? I think he is trying to speak, but not succeed, but we're not hearing for some reason.
We had this problem. So I beg your pardon for butting in, Howard. We had this problem earlier on before the meeting started. He was could you please disconnect and reconnect, and that might establish your communication again.
Right. Shall we proceed anyway? And in fact, you're next in the queue, Steve.
Yeah. It's actually a question for Mike. Which relates to financialization. He mentioned in his talk in passing, what's he called? This economist called Hudson. I think Michael Hudson is an American economist who talks a lot about financialization and identifying this as a specific new form. I get this impression it's supposedly a specific new form of capitalism. And I'd just like to get his comments on that, if he's able to speak.
Can you hear me now?
Got you.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, we can hear you now, Mike. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Leon, as well, for your comments. I was just going to say about Japan, first of all, that it seems like it's changed a lot in the 30 years I've been here. It was more insular and sort of navel-gazing. So I think people have more of a sense of what's going on. Actually, I think people are quite well aware of things that are going on, but there is a tendency to sort of look in on itself as a society, I guess you could say. But as far as that, just one more thing that Leon said about the global economy, I think, at the same time, politics sort of takes place within the nation state, and capitalists haven't been able to overcome the nation state either, which is kind of interesting. So, I mean, I agree, capitalism is a global system, of course, but things do play out on a national level as well, I think. It's not saying you can be an island unto yourself. I mean, Japan as an island country, but truly isolating, of course, that's impossible, but I guess, yeah, maybe Konishi's view is that you do have to still analyze each country, especially since I think he's interested in how this is all going to play out politically at some point. So he also doesn't really ignore the global economy. He talks about how, for example, the fact that Japan's domestic markets are stagnating has forced it to shift a lot of production overseas. But I think his point is that this is not really bringing a lot of benefits except to the, you know, capitalist firms themselves. So I think he's well aware, of course, that capitalism is a global system, but at the same time thinks there's merit in analyzing Japanese capitalism as well. And sorry, I didn't quite catch the bit about financialization exactly. I'm sorry, Steve.
Oh, okay. Can I put the question again then? You mentioned in passing Michael Hudson, who's I've watched several videos of his talks. He's always going on about this idea of financialization as though it's some sort of new type of capitalism. But I think you also mentioned that, which I've not seen, is that he's a proponent of the Chinese model. I appreciate he's a professor at Peking Beijing University.
Oh really? I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Okay. So I wonder if you've got some information about what his position on China.
I've only just listened to him, you know, on YouTube and whatnot. But I mean, his critique of the U.S. is sort of interesting. But he does seem to have this. I think he would have loved Japan in the 1970s too, because I mean, or the United States in the 1950s, because like in those countries, the financial system was more geared toward real capital, real production. I mean, I think that's Konishi's point. It's not like Japan suddenly shifted away from that because they said, oh, let's do something else. It's that literally they didn't have a choice. I mean, they you know, the thing started to sort of, their high growth period sort of petered out in the 80s and they had that huge speculative bubble, but it's not like they just saw, let's shift away from real capital and head towards financialization. For him, it's like, it's just a sign that there's really no choice but to do that. If there's no real, if capital investment is decreasing, there's not as much investment on the infrastructure because there's not much possibility to gain the sort of profits they could in the past because markets are saturating or whatnot. So I think Hudson seems to not really realize, view things very historically, as far as I can tell. I think it's true that Chinese capitalism, the financial system, is not like floating off on its own somewhere. It's geared towards real production for the most part. So he thinks that's great, but like, let's check back in 10 years and see what's happened. Cause I mean, it could very well be in the same rut that Japan is in right now, as far as I can tell.
Thanks, Mike. Paul, you now.
Sorry, can I come back? Can I come back, Howard?
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike. Don't expect you to be an expert on every single modern economist. So, but it sounds to me, what you've said there about these people seems to me they've got all to the wrong end of the stick. That there was no capital investment going on in Japan, therefore we've got to go into finance. This is nonsense. I'm not saying what you said is nonsense, but this is a nonsensical idea, because capital will always go to look for the when it can, for cheaper labor power. Sorry, and therefore so they've gone offshore for that reason in particular, and also for.
We've lost you now, Steve, I'm afraid.
I couldn't hear you. Sorry, the last bit.
I think we get the point you're making there. And actually, when we discussed this on Friday without Mike being present, I think Adam made a similar point that in the end, it's a capital will look for sort of, you know, production. It's got to produce the goods and services and so on that it can sell.
I should say one thing about Konishi's point of view is that he does agree that, you know, the financialization, it can't just go off on its own. I mean, ultimately, the stock market, I think he uses the term capital gains and income gains. So like income gains would be interest and dividends. And since interest is very low in Japan, I mean, capital heads off into capital gains, you know, like the securities, the stock market. But at the same time, that's also, you know, influenced by interest rates. It's not totally separate from the real economy. So that was one point I should mention, that he thought, if you look at the long term, I mean, I think he has a chart with like nominal GDP and then the global stock prices or something, and show that they are sort of corresponding with each other. So it's not like the stock market's flying off into the universe and then not tied down by anything. So, I mean, ultimately, yeah, it's just like I think Adam said on Friday, I mean, the stock market is just sort of, it's not producing any wealth on its own. It's just taking money from one pocket and putting it in another pocket. So ultimately, yeah, the real economy has to, I mean, its presence has to be felt in the end, I think.
Thanks, Mike. I'm not sure if we've got Steve back with us, but it looks like we've not, but okay. Should we go on to Paul?
Cheers. Thanks again, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about, the idea of, you know, although capitalism has its fundamental system of wealth being exploited, how some capitalists get there. There are different ways, even although the same underlying rules apply. You take, for example, the two richest men in the world, certainly they were the last time I looked at it, the head of Microsoft. He obviously got to where he was by direct exploitation of workers who, you know, created the ideas, produced the goods, distributed them by you know, his own cash investments, and then creaming off the profits therein. So he was what you might describe as a direct exploiter of capitalism, or capitalist of the wage paying system. Then, of course, is it Jeff Bezos, the top dog from Amazon, who, you know, created the whole kind of marketplace, and he, I think, the richest person in the world now, having got there just by sort of steaming off the profits by way of sort of markups, if you like. You know, in other words, the workers are being exploited almost twice, for want of a better way of describing it, just by having a facility where people can go online and order things that have already been produced, are sitting there waiting to be resold, from which he gets his 5, 10, 15% cut. Obviously, there are workers in between working in warehouses and things that have to move these products around, but still he doesn't really, to the best of my knowledge anyway, employ workers in factories direct. He just creams off the profit, or profits from the profits that have already existed. I mean, similarly, the other thing I would say about, and I know we don't want to, and I'm not going to highlight issues of that identity politics. What I would say about it is that, you know, although we all have in common being working class, I think it's perfectly fair and reasonable to identify with subgroups from in the working class, you know, whether we like it or not. It's not everyone's favourite thing. Adam described, expressed his views very, very, you know, strongly, and I get that. But I think, you know, we have to embrace each other's diversity, and we have to accept that although we might be equal, we're also different. In one way or another, some people do want to identify, you know, like attracts like, for example. There may be, you know, the gay community, the black community, the white community, the disabled community, lots of different communities within the same sort of subsidiaries of within the same heading of working class. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to be part of these subgroups, to identify with these subgroups as well as being a member of the working class. I wouldn't want to, of course, you know, the capitalist class and the rules and the lawmakers and governments will try to exploit that. But I think the important thing is for us to kick that back and say, well, look, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to have diversity, to embrace each other's likes, dislikes, and preferences, and as Paddy rightly says, to respect them, you know. So I certainly think there is a reasonable place for identifying with something other than just pure working class. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Shall we go to Warwick now? Are you there, Warwick?
Hi. Sorry. Thank you very much. I had a very pleasant surprise in finding this discussion happening. Usually I haven't been attending the Friday night discussion, sorry, because two reasons. One is that starts at 6 o'clock in the morning or 6:30, and I'm usually having a lion on Saturday. And then I get up about 8 and have to go off to the fruit and veggie market because we're all... But it's really great having this discussion. I don't know if this is off topic, but the whole issue of nationalism versus internationalism and the conversion of capitalism to socialism, I've got a couple of points of optimism, and they're all based around the internet, actually. The first thing is even this discussion, being, you know, have this, the ease of this discussion being international, great. And I'm seeing the rise, I think, of international, let's say, working class parties. So I often listen to George Galloway's talkback, and many of you probably know who George Galloway is, the ex-Labour MP, and he's now got a workers' party, and that's on YouTube. He has talks on YouTube. Then there's that chap who was the finance minister in Greece, and the EU did him over. What was his name? Yanis Varoufakis. They've got a movement called Democracy in Europe movement. Now, that's a reformist movement, but he sees huge problems in capitalism. What I'm saying is, we've now got the technology that enables ideas to be spread very rapidly, no matter what country in the world people live. The second point about optimism is I've been watching, I watch a lot of YouTube nowadays, and there's a chap called Peter Diamandis. Now, he is he's an entrepreneur, but he set up a thing called, he's actually a medical doctor by training, and he set up a thing called Singularity University, and I won't go into what Singularity is, you can look it up for yourself, but he's talking about all the different technological possibilities, how we can have superabundance. Hey, that's a familiar term, isn't it? But he sort of, I don't know if he uses that term, but that's what he's talking about. And one of the things one of his videos, you can look it up, called Demonetizing Living. And I thought, here we go. Here is a person who's encouraging investment, but maybe he does know. Maybe he does know, but maybe he doesn't. He's actually, in doing so, that investment is all about demonetizing living so that we can end up with a moneyless, classless society. He doesn't need that. I wonder whether he understands that he is undermining the very society that he's supporting, or maybe he does. So there's those two elements, and they're both based on the internet, the spread of ideas, international parties, and the idea using technology to enhance the demonetization of living. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Warwick. Thanks very much. Danny wants to make a comment. Can you unmute him, Steve? Thanks. Okay, Danny.
Just a couple of points. I'm very brief. If you'd be patient with me, that's identity policies is fine with capitalism because capitalism itself runs on mistaken identity, as I might have said before. We cannot exploit or oppress or abuse in any way those we identify with. And as far as class consciousness goes, I think class is basically a result of a lack of human consciousness. If people know what it is to be human, they're not going to tolerate being put in a working class and be exploited and being used. So I think human consciousness is to ruffle up the root a bit more. Human consciousness is essential, and I'll leave it with you.
Oh, you're muted.
Thanks very much, Steve. Sorry about that. I was just saying that we've been going for about an hour and a half. Danny has made a couple of comments there, which I think sort of puts the socialist case in a nutshell in a way. I wonder whether this would be the point at which we could maybe ask Mike if he wants to offer some kind of summing up to his talk and to sort of some of the comments he's heard, if he wants to.
I can try. I think my talk, it raised more questions than it answered. So, and I, in a way, I feel more confused now, maybe than when I started. But yeah, I guess some of the questions that are still in my mind is, some of, just like what Work was just saying, perhaps is one example, but what are the things we can point to, in addition to, of course, like the socialization of labor and some of the things that Marx talked about, what are some of the things we can look to as real conditions or signs of socialist consciousness or the possibility of socialism in the not too distant future? I guess what I'm still confused about is just, you know, the relation between, if you want to call it objective reality, and our way of thinking, and how that's going to make making the case for socialism easier, perhaps. I guess I just sort of left with a lot of questions in my mind, unfortunately. which makes it a bit hard to sum up. But I guess I just like to thank everyone for, you know, taking the time to come, not just on Friday, but then today as well. I really appreciate it. And it's a bit strange to talk to you all, because I've been listening to the Discord talks for the past year, which has been a real, it's just been really great for a person that, like me, who's, you know, a bit isolated. I'm down here in Miyazaki in the south of Japan. Not a lot of socialists around here. So listening to the talks has been great. So it's kind of strange. I recognize all your voices. I know your names. But for you, it's probably the first time to hear me drone on like this. So that's been kind of interesting. And unfortunately, the normal time is just kind of doesn't work out for me time zone wise. But hopefully occasionally maybe people can get together on Sunday once in a while. That would be really great as far as I'm concerned. So I just want to thank everyone. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike. Presumably you've been listening to the recorded versions of the talks. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Okay. Steve's put a message asking Warwick to put his references in the speaking queue if he can. Okay. The references he referred to in his contribution. Thanks very much indeed, Mike. That's very interesting session indeed. Good attendance as well, which is great on a Sunday morning. And
thank you.
Okay, and thanks to everyone for attending, and we'll see you, is it next Friday now, I think, isn't it, the next one? Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.